Hello and welcome to the final Inside Education of 2015, coming to you on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Every week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish point of view. My name is Sean Delaney and you can find links to all 235 previous Inside Education podcasts on seandelaney.com/podcasts. Well, as 2015 draws towards a close, on this programme we are looking back at education in Ireland in 2015 and looking forward to 2016. One way to do this is to use the Education Matters Yearbook for 2015-2016, which was published recently. A PDF copy of the book can be downloaded from educationmatters.ie. This year, the Education Matters Yearbook was edited by Brian Mooney. Brian is a guidance counsellor in Oatlands College and a columnist with the Irish Times. I met up with Brian during the week to ask him to reflect on developments and events in Irish education in 2015. I first asked him how 2015 will be remembered from an education perspective.
I suppose we'll remember 2015 from the perspective of what happened and didn't happen in terms of junior cycle reform. And I suppose wearing a number of hats, obviously, my role in the Irish Times in writing about this, my role as a guidance counsellor working in second level, and my role as editor of Education Matters, I'm seeing it from different perspectives. But in a sense, the fact that it is now being rolled out, that the negotiations between the union representatives and the minister were successfully completed in the summer, every single aspect of the problems that were the unions presented to the minister were resolved, to the satisfaction of everybody around the table. And yet we have a scenario where basically the ASTI is still not involved in the process. I think that it is something that will come back to bite us in 2016, but it is a serious problem within the system which we really need to look at.
How do you think it's going to be resolved?
I've been involved in second level education for 40 years, and there has been an underlying tension between the practitioner on the ground and what you might call the leadership in terms of the professional full-time leadership in terms of particularly the ASTI. And it's almost like there's a resentment there among a cohort of teachers on the ground to the very existence of people sitting in offices doing jobs paid for by their subs, you know, basically helping to run the union. And I in my early years teaching, I was very involved in the union, and you'd be at conferences. I remember it was Kieran Mulvey's day as General Secretary. And this kind of seething resentment that, you know, he had an office and he sat in an office and he was paid more than they were, and yet they were at the coalface. And I think there's an element of that in terms of the dispute we're at here, that, you know, these people went forward, the issues that were addressed, and it's almost as if there's a cohort within teaching that's saying, I don't care what we wanted, whatever you got, the answer is no, and it'll always be no. You know, and it's like, you wonder, where is that coming from? There's also another reality, I suppose, and we wonder why only 38% of the teaching population in the ASTI voted on the junior cycle reform. I'm in teaching long enough. In fact, I'm in education long enough to have been in education before free education. I started in Oatlands College as a student in 1966, and it was only the following year that the debate as to whether this college, Oaklands College, would have gone into this free scheme, and the Archbishop at the time, Dr. McQuaid, was pushing to have a free scheme school in South Dublin with the Christian Brothers. So effectively the compromise in the end was that Monkstown stayed out and Oaklands went in. So effectively, you know, within a few years we had a surge of people coming through at Leaving Cert levels far in excess of anything that the universities could handle. The first problem that arose was the college decided, how are they going to discriminate between all these people who met the entry requirements? And we ended up with points. And the minute you got points, you got to a scenario where parents began to realise that automatic movement on to third level, which it was for me, effectively, once you had your 2 C's and 4 D's, was no longer there. And therefore, the whole agenda at second level changed to being, what do you do to maximise the points? So you got the whole grind school phenomenon. You got the development of this attitude that all that really mattered was how many grades you were going to get. And that, in a sense, has created the reality that I worked in as a teacher all my life and that every teacher that I know faces. If you go to a parent-teacher meeting and that all the teachers are sitting around, If there's a teacher there whose subject is not exam-based, the PE teacher or the RE teacher or whatever, they will be sitting there looking at the wall while everybody else has queues out the door. And the reality of that, I think, for teachers, when they see a group of people on their behalf in the NCCA for a number of years looking at, you know, curriculums on well-being or whatever, they treat that with a large degree of cynicism, because they know that in the end of the day, the parents, who are the ones that they have to answer to, want points, and they want points delivered. So the whole agenda of curriculum reform, junior cycle reform, or more holistic education, many people on the ground see that as having no reality when it comes to what parents actually want. So part of the reason for the non-participation, even in the vote, you have your ballot paper, it's sitting at home. Why do 62% of the people just leave it there and just throw it in the bin? Because they probably feel that in the end of the day, no more than when the inter-cert was replaced by the junior cert, that parents will still want the points. And where does it come from? The pressure point that we genuinely do not have enough facilities in third level to cope with the number of students coming through. And I think that that's possibly one of the reasons why there is that level of cynicism.
I mean, that's a very interesting thesis, that ironically, by introducing free second level education, we've turned education into a transaction rather than something that is actually an end and something worthwhile in itself.
Because effectively, when I did the Leaving Cert in 1971, all I needed was 2 C's to go to college. And it was my choice to do so. It wasn't the choice of the vast majority of people doing the Leaving Cert, but because effectively college was not seen as the choice of the majority, and many people would have left before Leaving Cert. But once you got free education, and once you got the numbers going from 20% up to 40%, and now from 60 to 70%, we never developed our third level system. In fact, one of the most interesting things for me in 2015 was I was at a meeting out in Louis Fitzgerald's hotel a couple of weeks ago with 8 Dutch universities who had come to Ireland because they are now seeing growing numbers of Irish students going to Dutch universities, taught through English, because there's over 1,000 degree courses taught through English in European universities at the moment. And they actually have a shortage of students, because the population structure in Western Europe is such that there are not sufficient students to fill the available places. So you can go to a Dutch university in an area like physiotherapy or psychology, or the ones that are 500 plus points here in Ireland, and you can do that for your 2 C's and 4 D's. Now, you'll work your butt off in first year to stay there because they are very competitive universities, but getting in isn't a problem. And Irish students who have gone over there and said, this is too good to be true, how can this be? There's a catch here somewhere. The fees are 1,900 as opposed to 3,000 here. They can get grants from the Dutch government. If they go to Denmark, they get paid 650 euros a month. And the Danish government, by the way, tried to confine that to Danish students and lost in the European court. So it's almost like it's too good to be true. And yet the numbers are growing exponentially in 2015 because people are beginning to see this is for real. So I think we have a problem in Ireland long term because we're not living in a bubble. We're actually in a European Union. Universities have to get students. In most of Western Europe, that is a problem. In Ireland, we have 55,000 students doing the Leaving Cert now. In 10 years' time, it'll be 75,000. And unless we have a radical expansion of our third level system, we are not going to be able to cope with those numbers in our system. Thankfully, the European system is there. But the problem is that the people who may go may be the very ones that the universities are trying to attract, which are the really intelligent and bright kids. And we are in a more competitive environment, and they are only beginning to realise that effectively they have to compete for these students. But given the numbers coming through, Europe's problem is in fact our salvation.
That's a very interesting aspect of this whole story. If we get back to the junior cert reform, and It seems to me that in that whole story, the minister has really been in a difficult situation, because she was seen by some to have compromised and to have given too much to the teacher unions. And on the other hand, then she still hasn't satisfied the teacher unions. How do you look on her position at this stage now in 2015?
I think she did a very skillful job. Rory Quinn was a minister for finance in the 1990s, and as minister for education, the one thing Rory Quinn was not going to do was to end up in a financial dispute with the minister for finance, because he had to sit in that chair himself. So when he was asked to deliver on particular financial targets when they came into government in 2011, he literally looked and said, where can we make savings? One of the savings that was proposed to him was they could save 15 million by abolishing the correction of the junior certificate. It had been on a list of potential savings since 2009. The previous government had not ticked that box, and he basically said, look, I have a report here from the NCCA which is recommending this junior cycle reform. That report did not suggest that that they would abolish correcting it externally. But some bright spark, possibly in his office, suggested, well, look, if we took that 15 million recommendation and put it into this junior cycle recommendation, then we've saved 15 million. They also, by the way, cut guidance and counselling, which is a whole different agenda, which has been a disaster, and saved them about 30-something million. But at the end of the day, Rory always delivered on the financial targets. So when the teacher unions balked at that, and I wrote about this in the Irish Times, I said I completely supported the industrial action because I believe that actually having a terminal exam that's externally marked gives a credibility to the entire 3 years of the junior cycle process. It gives a validity to it. And I believed in that very, very strongly. So when Jan came into office, she found herself in a situation where she had a couple of hand grenades with the pins hanging out. And she basically, although it's never going to be admitted, decided to unravel all the Quinn proposals back to the original NCCA proposals. And when they actually sat around the table last summer, my belief is that that's what happened. And she basically said, guys, look, OK, she didn't want to rub Rory's nose in it. But effectively what happened was she went back to the original NCCA proposals. And the TUI and the ASTI, who had been at the table when these were negotiated, were perfectly happy with that. And effectively, the proposals that went back to the TUI and the ASTI were the proposals that were originally in the original document. The only problem is that within the ASTI, because of the reasons we've already discussed, even if the proposals had been gold trimmed, they would have still been rejected because it's not about the issue. It's about getting the leadership. It's about that you know, kind of insurrectional anger that's out there from a group of people who basically dominate the controls of the structures within the ASTI. Now, I know this is very controversial stuff, but most young teachers nowadays do not engage in going to branch meetings where you sit for 2 or 3 hours discussing business in relation to, you know, financial accounts and, you know, treasurer's reports and all that sort of thing. And even if they did turn up, they would probably be deemed not to be particularly welcome. So effectively, you have a group of people who are there, maybe for ideological reasons, for a whole series of other reasons. And effectively, their agenda may have very little to do with the issues that we're actually discussing here. And, you know, it didn't really matter what came back. So effectively, I think Jan has done a very good job in that sense. And it's really a matter for the ASTI to resolve, because having rejected that and having rejected Lansdowne Road, effectively, things are going to start affecting people's salaries in the first months of 2016. And once it starts hitting people in the pocket, they're going to wake up and begin to realise, hang on a second, where are we going? But the truth is, there's a lack of engagement. I'm actually aware of a branch of the ASTI up in the northeast where effectively every single member that involved is retired. There's not one active person, but because retired people are still allowed to participate. So effectively, we have a ludicrous situation with people who aren't involved or making decisions for people who are involved who aren't interested in being involved, and work that one out and see where we're going.
Yeah, it definitely is a dilemma for unions in the future.
Yeah.
If members are not engaging with them.
Well, you see, there was a proposal there, was it last year, in relation to reforming the structures of the ASTI. But it was like asking turkeys to vote for Christmas, because the people who were actually making the decisions were the people who would have become utterly irrelevant and redundant. So they basically stymied that and the thing collapsed. So we're left with structures which were designed for the 1950s and 60s. And people nowadays, they communicate, you know, on their mobile phones, they communicate electronically, they make decisions electronically, they book tickets for the holidays electronically, and they are not going back to old technology of sitting in hotel rooms for 2 or 3 hours once a month, having debates about issues that the vast majority of them don't really care terribly much about. But that's how the democratic structures of the union work. We've rejected all the changes that were proposed, so effectively, there's been a total disconnect and disenfranchisement. But when people begin to get frustrated, when they see that they're not getting increments that the TUI colleagues are getting, or that others are getting in the INTO, they're going to say, how do we get out of this? But within the structures, there's no way for them to actually effectively operate.
Okay, that's interesting. Apart from the junior cert reform and what we've said about the unions and so on, what else is going to be memorable about education in 2015?
Well, in doing the job as editor of Education Matters, what fascinates me is, you know, the way that, for instance, the preschool is beginning to develop. And, you know, I think that has been one of the most fantastic innovations in Irish education in the last number of years. The fact that we are giving a quality education now to children from 3 to 5, I think will have transformational effects down the road, because it is giving an early start, particularly in communities where effectively we haven't had to date, you know, that level of support. I'm really interested in the work that was done by Josephine Bleach and her colleagues down in the north inner city there, you know, in which, based in NCI, and there's huge credit to NCI for the work that they did there and the support that they gave over the number of years, where effectively you're taking the local community, basically the grannies, and you're bringing them to a level of education where they're going in, and to the single mammies and etc., and they're helping the mothers to acquire the skills to help the kids who are now getting the early education. I think we're going to see a huge transformation down the road in terms of the quality of those children's education as they come through the system. It's only been in place for 4 or 5 years. The extension this year, I think, is going to be really, really helpful. The only problem is these people aren't paid. They're paid minimum wage. And, you know, with the hold that the INTO have over salaries in primary education, whether we're ever going to get to a stage where the people who are engaged in what is a highly professional skill, educating 3 to 5 year olds, are going to get the recognition they require to be able to get salary scales, you know, relevant to the skills they're using. I think that is an issue going forward. I think another huge issue for 2015 is this whole area of religious education. Now, I was coordinating the programme in UCD for teaching teachers in religious education, and also in Mater Dei, for 15 or 20 years. And I'm utterly committed to quality religious education. But we have a crisis in this country. And the crisis is a crisis brought about by the state. In the editorial in Education Matters, I make the argument, and I think Archbishop Martin can see this very, very clearly. There is no point in having Catholic schools if, in fact, 30-35% of the students in those schools are actually committed to what you're doing and the parents of those students, and 60% of them are not committed. Now, 30% are perfectly happy to go along with the communion confirmation as a social event, and they want their kids in the process, and 30% may not want them involved at all. And possibly less than 30% of the teachers doing the teaching are also in any way actively committed to doing it. So you have a huge number of teachers who are teaching children in preparation for communion, confirmation and other religious material in primary schools, who themselves do not practice, are absolutely clear in their own minds that they are doing this under duress to a certain extent. And you can imagine what perception the children have of that activity. They probably see it as total cynicism. And if you're teaching children cynicism at that age, one would wonder why they would have it in adult life. So I would see what we're facing actually is a crisis for faith community schools. I think that what we have, and I think they would be only thrilled if there was a state model where they say, look, if you're not committed to our faith tradition, go to the other school. But because the other school doesn't exist, these parents rightly are demanding education for their children. They want them in the schools. But effectively, what you end up with is nothing, because they're neither Catholic schools, because many of the Catholic supposed teachers aren't practicing Catholics. And a lot of what's going on in the classroom, a large majority of the children and their parents have no commitment to it either. So I think we need to get to a scenario very, very quickly where the state takes responsibility for moving this on. But the problem is the parents are perfectly happy with the present scenario. Those that are sending their children to Catholic schools because they're Catholic are happy. The people who see it as a social event are perfectly happy. But the only people with a problem are the people who really don't want their children exposed to religious education, which is a small minority. And they're not enough to persuade the rest of the parents in that school to divest that school from being a Catholic school to being a state school. So we're stuck.
And how can that be resolved?
Well, the point is, if the decision is always going to be with the parents, you are stuck. The only way it could be resolved is if the church authorities made a decision with the government, that school is going to be the local Catholic school and that school is going to be the state school. And if you want a Catholic education, you go there. And if you don't, whatever. But because in a sense, everybody is susceptible to public pressure, I can't see that happening. So we're going to be in a situation where those who want a Catholic education for their children are going to feel hard done by. And those who don't want their children exposed to any religious are going to feel hard done by. But possibly the majority is in the middle. And they're calling the shots.
The OECD issued a report during the year which seemed to cast some negativity maybe on the role of technology in schools. What impact, if any, do you think that's likely to have?
Well, I don't think that the OECD report is actually questioning the technology in schools. What they're probably questioning is the capacity of the teaching profession to effectively use technology in schools. Somebody who is a very good teacher and is up to speed on technology, all of those people are absolutely capable of using technology in a way that hugely enhances the education process. The problem arises is that if you have an introduction or a rollout of technology in the education system in a school, but the teacher himself is a mile and a million miles behind the capacity of the children to use technology, then what will actually be happening on the screens of the computers bears very, very little relationship to the to quality education. And the teacher is not capable of bringing it to that space. So I would suggest, based on the OECD report, that if we're considering, you know, rolling out technology in schools, the first thing you need to do is to take your teaching profession and bring them to a level of capacity to use technology effectively, and then roll it out to the children. Because effectively, just rolling it into the school is not effective. It's probably damaging education. It would be far preferable that the teacher stays with his paper book, so long as that's what he's competent and skilled at, until the level of technological training is brought to him or her so that they can use technology effectively. And I think that's maybe where the OECD was coming from.
If we look ahead to 2016, Brian, what do you think teachers and students and policymakers are going to be talking about and thinking about then?
Well, first of all, we're going to have a new minister, although, you know, it could be John O'Sullivan, but I don't think that she expects to be in that role, even if she's returned and Labour is back in government. Although I would be very happy to see her in the role. I think she's been a good minister over the last year and a half. I think we're going to have a slow movement towards a crisis with the junior cycle reform, because the department is committed to it. It's going to roll out. The TUI are rolling it out in their schools.
On a practical level, if you have a school that has some TUI members and some ASTI members, how would junior cycle reform happen in those schools?
My belief is that at the moment that the teacher education section in rolling it out is trying not to antagonise. But I can tell you confidentially that effectively I am aware that there are many teachers who are teaching in junior cycle classes, particularly the English teachers, who are ringing the teacher education section of the department looking for advice over the phone in terms of the rollout of this program. So effectively what may be actually happening around the country is that teachers, they're banned from going to in-service, but they're quietly asking to be given in-service effectively over the telephone, and they're probably, even though they're not supposed to be, delivering that so that their own students will not end up in a crisis situation. So if that is happening in any kind of wide scale, and I'm aware that it is happening, then effectively this dispute will just unravel. That's the worst of both worlds, particularly for the unions. I think the problems in relation to the salary issue around Haddington Road may begin to create problems as we go into September, as people begin to realise that they're actually losing money as a result of it. That may lead to industrial relations problems. We'll have a new government, and as we always know with new governments, you know, hard decisions will be taken. The funding issue, I think, is going to be a huge issue. The recommendations which are coming from Peter Cassell's report, particularly around the area of whether it's going to be a loan scheme or not, I think that will be a major bone of contention. I don't believe we should go down the UK road of having large fees that are then levied on students as a loan down the road, because in truth, much of that money won't get repaid, and I don't think it's a particularly effective way of funding third level. Particularly as we talked about earlier, if our students could go on the continent for free, what's that going to do if, you know, your choice is between a debt of 25,000 at home or going to Holland? I was actually speaking to somebody this morning recounting details of a student in Holland who's, say, sending money home at this stage. She's doing so well. So effectively, I think we need to look at the funding model in context of a broader European context in which Irish students can now operate.
There was also a national access plan launched recently. Do you think that's going to have much of an impact on recruiting students from underrepresented groups to third level?
I think that what we talked about earlier in terms of the early childhood education long term is going to effectively improve access. I think that access issues that are being put in, even in second level, it's almost too late, because effectively the perceptions of children are formed at very early ages. And if they see third level as something they want, you know, in primary school, they will stick with it. If they've already switched off and are just waiting to leave the education system. Access has been hugely successful. It has really improved. But I think that the level that we were hoping to get to will be got to when we actually ensure that children at the very earliest ages have an energy and enthusiasm for education, which may not be there in some communities yet.
And the Teaching Council is going to be rolling out more of its fitness to practice hearings next year. Do you think that will attract much attention in 2016?
I would say that that will be a very slow rollout process. I think that, you know, the last thing they want, obviously, is to create further problems when you've got these issues, particularly in the ASTI, still rumbling on. I think there will be an attempt made to ensure that, yes, we will get into this. It's part of what being a professional involves, and we've seen it with the medical people and various cases in the last couple of years in which, you know, consultants have found themselves, you know, being pilloried over the quality of their work. It will happen in teaching, but I would say it would be a really gradual process.
And finally, Brian, as we leave 2015 and enter 2016, are you optimistic or pessimistic looking at the new year?
I'm very optimistic. I think that there is a commitment to education in Ireland and a commitment to what education represents. I said it in my editorial, you know, we had really good times 10 years ago, and yet the education budget didn't grow as a proportion of the overall state budget. I would hope that this time around, as we begin to recover, that we can see that quality in education is a real investment in the future of our young people and in our economy, and that hopefully, as things improve, that we can invest in education at all levels to provide us with a future for all our people which brings out the best in everybody's potential.
And that was Brian Mooney ending the final programme of 2015 on a positive note. Brian edited the Education Matters handbook this year, and I want to thank him for taking the time to speak with me. Remember, you can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can contact me with suggestions by emailing insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That's it from me for this week and for 2015. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, from me, Sean Delaney, thank you for listening this week, and I hope you have a peaceful and educational 2016.